climate change, pollution, and deforestation are harming frogs and salamanders.
We oftentimes refer to amphibians as sort of analogous to canaries in the coal mines.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, the threats to amphibians around the world and closer to home, including a fungus that wreaks havoc on their skin.
So that causes a cardiac arrest, finally, for the frog, and then that's how they actually end up dying.
But citizen scientists, including kids, are learning the ropes out in the field to try to help.
Be quiet for 2 minutes so the frogs can get used to us.
Plus, how the past might help us act more boldly now on climate change.
Where we have had major change in our history, the rational appeal is joined by a much more urgent moral appeal.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. The Pennsylvania Department of Health has determined there is no cancer cluster in a Washington County school district. The agency conducted the study after several cases of a rare bone cancer were reported there. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier has more.
The report's main conclusion, cancer rates weren't higher than expected in either Washington County or the Cannon-McMillan School District. The study did find that between 2005 and 2017, rates of Ewing sarcoma were 3 times higher than normal in the school district. The rare tumor mainly affects young people and can be fatal. The author said the number of cases was so small, just 3 instances of Ewing sarcoma in the district over those years, that the higher than expected rates weren't, quote, statistically significant. The state initiated this study after numerous calls from residents worried about reports of the disease in the district. Only about 200 cases of the tumor are reported in the U.S. each year. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
A panel of Democratic state senators heard from experts Tuesday in Pittsburgh on how to combat methane emissions from the natural gas industry. State Impact Pennsylvania's Amy Sisk has more.
Methane is a potent greenhouse gas that contributes to climate change. Sometimes it can leak from well pads and other pieces of natural gas infrastructure. Energy engineering professor Arvind Ravikumar at Harrisburg University says leak detection is advancing. Historically, crews have had to drive to a gas site and operate a camera to spot emissions. New technologies make that possible from drones and planes. Ravikumar says businesses are forming around those technologies in Alberta, where he's worked with regulators in the oil and gas industry.
Given the scale of natural gas activity in Pennsylvania, I see no reason why we cannot have these companies set up operations out of Pittsburgh.
Officials in Pennsylvania have proposed new rules to prevent leaks. Ravikumar says regulations will help lower the cost of those technologies as more gas producers adopt them on a wider scale. Amy Sisk, State Impact Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania officially has a new state amphibian. WITF's Katie Meyer reports it may not be pretty, but supporters of the Eastern Hellbender say it's a vital reminder to keep streams and waterways healthy.
As Senator Jean Yaw notes, the Hellbender goes by many names.
The Allegheny alligator, lasagna lizard, mud puppy. You know, and probably my favorite, I have to say this, is snot otter. So.
The Bradford County Republican recalls a group of high schoolers with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation Student Leadership Council pitched the slimy river dweller as state amphibian in 2016. Current council president Emma Stone says giving the hellbender a special designation is a way to raise awareness.
The health of hellbenders is directly linked to the health of the water across the Commonwealth.
It so happens Democratic Governor Tom Wolf is pushing a package of infrastructure improvements that includes waterway preservation. It would be funded by a perennially unsuccessful tax on natural gas drilling. Asked if he supports the plan, Yaw says he does in theory. But he and other skeptical Republicans are debating funding with the administration. Katie Meyer in Harrisburg.
Well, while the hellbender is getting some much-needed attention, amphibians around the world are in trouble. They're dying. And a particularly nasty fungus called chytrid is playing a major role.
It is a member of the phylum Chytridiomycota, and it's one of only two species in that phylum that's known to infect vertebrates.
That's Michelle Omer, a postdoctoral researcher at the Richards Zawacki Lab at the University of Pittsburgh. She studies the chytrid fungus that affects amphibians.
Frogs, salamanders, and also caecilians, which are a really interesting worm-like amphibian that many people don't know about because they live underground.
Veronica Sines is a PhD student also working on the fungus.
Veronica, what does it do to the species that it infects?
The chytrid fungus affects the amphibian skin. The skin is really important in amphibians because they breathe through the skin and they're like ions transported from the water to the skin. So that causes a cardiac arrest, finally, for the frog, and then that's how they actually end up dying.
Electrolyte loss in humans, you know, if you're running, you need to drink a Powerade or something afterwards. So amphibians, if their skin is damaged by this fungus, they can lose a lot of electrolytes through their skin or various ions, and that is what can cause a lot of disruption to their bodily functions.
What impact has it had on amphibian populations?
So it has caused massive declines. More than 500 species have declined, which is impressive, actually. And many of them have gone extinct. And it's a huge loss for biodiversity.
So impressive, but horrifying.
Yes, horrifying, definitely. It's caused the worst declines in vertebrates.
So how has it spread and over how many years?
The greatest amphibian declines occurred in the 1980s, and that's when there were many researchers around the globe trying to figure out what was causing these declines. And later, in 1998, it was discovered that it was this fungus, Batrachochytrium dendrobatidis, or we like to call it BD for short because it's a lot easier to say. This fungus was discovered actually concurrently in the United States and in Australia. Researchers together determined that this was the pathogen or the fungus that was killing amphibians. And so recently, there's actually been a number of papers that have come out to demonstrate that the pathogen originated in Asia and likely was spread around the world via the pet trade and the food trade, actually, as well. As a result of these trades, invasive species have invaded various new locations around the world, and they're able to carry this fungus, and that impacts the native populations of amphibians.
Can a frog or an amphibian carry the fungus and not be infected itself?
So there are different species of frogs, and each species has its own susceptibility. So some of them are really susceptible to the fungus, so they will die pretty fast. And other species carry the fungus, but they are not affected. So they are vectors of the disease. So that means that they will transport the disease to other animals or to the water. BD lives in the water, and it has been detected like in crayfish and basically anything that's like pretty moist in the water, like, and has keratin, might carry the fungus.
Michelle, why has it been so rampant?
Well, because the fungus has a recent origin from Asia, so it spread from Asia and ended up in all these populations of amphibians that were naive to the fungus, especially in places like Central America and Eastern Australia. These populations had never experienced the fungus before. They didn't evolve with this pathogen, and so it caused a lot of declines, likely because they didn't have any resistance to the pathogen. Also, just because, as Veronica was saying, it lives in moist soil and in the water, so it's easily spread from one pond to the next. Even humans can carry the fungus on the soles of their boots if they're moving from one wetland to another. And so we're thinking that that's probably why it spreads so easily.
Does it impact local species?
We've been studying the chytrid fungus at the Pima Tuning Lab of Ecology, which is the University of Pittsburgh's field station. And we found really high prevalences of this pathogen at the ponds around the field station, and we do see amphibians dying from the fungus. But at this point, they're in a little bit of a homeostasis. The host and the pathogen are coexisting, so it's called an enzootic phase. It's no longer an epidemic. And this is really good until the environment shifts. So
For example, with climate change, we may see more epidemics happening because the environment has changed.
Because it's getting warmer or wetter? We know that that's a possibility in Pennsylvania.
Yes. So in Pennsylvania, it's going to get warmer and wetter. This might be good for some species of amphibian, but for other species that prefer cooler temperatures, they may actually become more susceptible to the pathogen because their immune system doesn't work as well at warmer temperatures.
In the East, they get the infection. Some of them declined in different, it depends on the weather, especially coming from overwintering in the spring, they get high infection loads. And then they could clear the infection in the summer. That's a general pattern that we have seen here in Pennsylvania, where the fungus does better at cooler conditions usually.
It's likely that certain species, in particular chorus frogs, may have declined as a result of the chytrid fungus. And also leopard frogs, particularly in the northern parts of their range, have also likely declined, at least potentially due to the chytrid fungus as well.
So what's being done to stop this? Is there anything that can be done to stop it or slow it?
I think at this point, it's very difficult to control the fungus in nature. There are some things that can be done to try and modify habitat. In Eastern Australia, it's been found that after hurricanes, certain streams become sunnier and amphibians are able to clear themselves of the fungus because they can elevate their body temperature by basking. So it may be possible to modify habitats a little bit to benefit the amphibian over the fungus. And also, it's very important that we stop the continued trade of amphibians, and in particular, avoid the introduction of another fungal pathogen that's been recently discovered in Europe, Batrachochytrium salamandrivorans, or BSAL for short. So BSAL hasn't made its way to North America yet, but North America has the greatest diversity of salamanders of anywhere in the world. And so it's really important that we don't have this new fungus invade North America, because we don't know what will happen to our populations here. You know, even local people can help stop the spread of this fungus. You can clean your boots between wetlands. You can clean your fishing gear, your waders, your kayaks. Let them dry out before you then move on to another pond. And that's important because there's actually different strains of the fungus as well. And so we don't want to continue to spread these different strains around, which may have different virulences or how strong or effective they are at hurting the amphibians.
It's really hard to get rid of the fungus, but one thing that is good actually is that some amphibians are actually developing some kind of immune defense towards the fungus, and that's some kind of hope for us for more survival.
Veronica Sines and Michelle Omer are researchers at the Richard Zawacki Lab at the University of Pittsburgh. There are more stories about wildlife from our series Wild PA at AlleghenyFront.org/WildPA. I'm Kara Holsapel. You're listening to The Allegheny Front. Decades ago, when an environmental lobbyist learned about the magnitude of the problem of climate change, he had a reasonable reaction.
I can't believe this is happening. Why has nobody dealt with this if we've known about it for so long?
Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, the story of how the U.S. almost dealt with climate change in the 1990s, but didn't. Stay tuned. As we just heard, amphibians globally are not doing very well. Researchers are trying to better understand what's going on, and a citizen science program that relies on volunteers to collect data is helping. As part of our Wild PA series, the Allegheny Front's Andy Kubis went through a training recently in Pittsburgh to learn more.
So we're going to do some frog biology, and then we're going to dive right into starting to recognize these different calls. All right. So
to become a certified frog watcher for Frog Watch USA, your ears do most of the work. Chris Davis is leading today's training.
So that's an easy way for you to remember it is, okay, if I hear something that sounds kind of like a woodpecker, it's a leopard frog.
Davis is the assistant director of the Pomatuning Laboratory of Ecology, and he has kind of an audio cheat sheet when it comes to remembering frog calls. This northern cricket frog sounds like marbles clicking. The green frog, unmistakable banjo plucking. And the American bullfrog sounds just like a lightsaber. FrogWatch USA started gathering data in 1998 and has chapters in every state. It's run by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. The data collected by volunteers are used to help make decisions about conservation and management. This was the first training in Pittsburgh. About 16 people came out.
My name is Simone Toppenberger, and we love frogs.
Toppenberger brought along her 10-year-old son, Ashwin. They have a pet tree frog at home.
It almost never makes sounds.
Everywhere we go, and especially Ashwin, he finds frogs. And so we like them, and we know that they're important sentinels for the environment, and so this sounds like a good thing to do.
Frogs are often thought of as indicators of environmental health.
This is Corey Richard-Zawacki, a frog biologist at the University of Pittsburgh who helped lead the training. She says frogs are key creatures to study when trying to understand how things like climate change or pesticides are affecting ecosystems.
We oftentimes refer to amphibians as sort of analogous to canaries in the coal mines. They have very permeable skin, which means that contaminants can easily make it from the environment into their bodies.
So what makes a good frog watcher?
What makes a good frog watcher? Someone who likes to be out in nature, so you don't actually have to get in the wetlands. You don't even have to get dirty most of the time. You just have to be out and listen for the frogs that you hear. It's actually a good thing, I think, for families to do together.
With the weather getting warmer, I decide to put Richard Zawacki's claim to the test and take my own family out on a frog watch expedition.
I'm Reggie Cubis. I'm 9 years old.
I'm Nate Cubis, and I'm 7.
I'm Dan Cubis. I'm 45.
Well, let's go.
Okay, let's
go.
All right, let's do this. The protocol requires that you start observing at least 30 minutes after sunset. So it's already pretty late when we head to Panther Hollow Lake in Pittsburgh's Schindley Park. Our gear is pretty simple.
A paper and a clipboard and a light.
The first step is to record the weather conditions.
It's warm, there's no rain.
And the type of wetland you are monitoring.
Pond, natural formed by a beaver dam, human-made.
What do you think?
Next, the acclimation period.
Be quiet for 2 minutes so the frogs can get used to us.
Then the monitoring session begins.
All right, I'll start my timer for 3 minutes.
Guys, you have to put your hands behind your ears like this so you can hear better. Like that, perfect.
It's only 3 minutes start to finish. And on this night, there are no frog sounds.
We're not hearing anything.
But as I learned in the training, even zeros are good data.
Because then they know if they're going extinct or not.
So we're putting a zero here. The lack of rivets and croaks at this pond is pretty disappointing for all of us. So we decide to hit one more spot. We head to a place called Salamander Park in the suburbs and Jackpot.
We just got out of the car and you can already hear the spring peepers. It sounds like they're saying peep, peep, kind of.
There's a ton of them here. We fill out our data sheet and mark the call intensity a 3, the highest.
I think this is a 3. A 3's continuous frog sounds.
The monitoring session takes only about 6 minutes from start to finish. And with our data collection all wrapped up, it's time to upload it to FrogWatch USA's online database. But we'll do that tomorrow. It's time to get these sleepy scientists in bed.
This is a pretty fun thing to do on a school night.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Andy Cubis.
See you guys later. Bye.
Did you know that decades ago, politicians from both parties in the U.S. endorsed taking action to avert climate change? I didn't. In fact, in 1989, the nations of the world gathered in a Dutch seaside resort town to discuss whether to impose a binding agreement to lower carbon dioxide emissions. But the U.S. opposed a binding agreement, and one was never signed. An account of that history is in the new book, Losing Earth, by Nathaniel Rich. Rich is a writer at large for the New York Times Magazine, and for our podcast, Trump on Earth, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier talked with him about the extraordinary events and people that might have radically altered the state of our planet.
So you tell the story of what happened in climate policy from roughly the years 1979 to 1989. I guess my first question is, why did you want to research this topic now?
On one hand, it's the story of this deeply frustrating failure. On the other hand, from a rosier perspective, it's the story of how a few people, ragtag group of activists, bureaucrats within the federal government, and scientists rallied together and over the course of a decade were able, through determination and perseverance and at great personal risk, to bring in an issue that up to then had been entirely in the domain of the sort of scientific literature and bring us as close as we've gotten to serious global climate policy.
There was an awesome Earth Day warning from a government scientist in remarks prepared for the American Geophysical Union in Washington, said pollution and overpollution, unless checked, could so warm the Earth in 200 years as to create a greenhouse effect, melting the Arctic ice cap and flooding vast areas of the world.
In many ways, we're still stuck in 89. I think that's true. It's certainly true with our policy, with our politics, and the way of thinking about it. Of course, that's the year when industry, as I relate this in the book, adopted this position of just total obstruction and to any kind of climate policy and propaganda, and they started to pay off scientists and politicians and ultimately a whole Republican Party. But before that point, it was a much more fluid moment.
We all know that human activities are changing the atmosphere in unexpected and in unprecedented ways.
It was not a partisan issue. There was scientific consensus and there was political consensus that something should be done. And so I thought by writing about this early period, it was also a way of writing about some of the larger questions that now face us.
I wanted you to talk a little bit about the two kind of protagonists for the book, Rafe Pomerantz, who's an environmental lobbyist, and the former NASA scientist James Hansen.
Yeah, they're sort of an unlikely pair of heroes.
First of all, Dr. Hansen, kindly say your name, spell your last name, give your title.
Well, I'm James Hansen. I'm the head of the Goddard Institute for Space Studies.
James Hansen's work I was familiar with. He became the face of climate science by the end of the 80s.
You've created quite a stir. Are you glad that the stir is happening?
Well, I think that, you know, what I'd like to say is that, frankly, I would rather do my research than be interviewed for TV.
He spoke up before Congress and said global warming is here now and it's time to act. And Pomerantz is just a charismatic, fascinating, smart, indefatigable guy who, when he was in his early 30s, sitting in the offices of Friends of the Earth, the environmental organization where he was a lobbyist at the time, in 1979, he came across the problem of global warming while reading an obscure government report from the EPA about coal. And he started to ask questions. He started to say, well, what is this existential crisis? Because it was already being expressed in those terms by even in this sort of dry print of this government pamphlet. And he said, what is this thing that I've never heard about? He was an air quality specialist. And he started to ask questions and he started to hold meetings with people at the highest levels of government. And he soon realized that it was up to him, as crazily as that seemed to him at the time, to try to bring this to the attention of the American public.
Our final speaker of the evening, Mr. Pomerantz, will discuss the environmental community's views on the question before us, global warming, myth or reality.
Thank you, Daphne. Let me deal with the topic of the evening, myth or reality, and go back a little bit, back to 1979 and the science of this question, because it helps, I think, helps to clarify how strong the consensus is in the scientific community.
Walk us through the sort of path that Rafe Pomerantz and Jim Hansen take to bring this issue into the public consciousness.
They're confronted with this information just as we are today. I think any thinking person, once we sort of understand the issue, we go through a certain kind of number of responses, and you see them going through these just decades earlier. So the first response is Rafe's response, which is essentially, you know, holy cow, we'll say, I can't believe this is happening. Why has nobody dealt with this if we've known about it for so long? Surely, if we can communicate the issue in stark terms to, you know, people in power in this country, out of prudence and just common sense, they will take certain actions right away. And so he goes around D.C. with a scientist, Gordon MacDonald, who is also very concerned about it and who is also extremely powerful within the government. He's essentially the chief scientist for the CIA. They go around meeting with people at EPA, State Department, Energy Department, which, by the way, has its own CO2 office already by that point, and ultimately to the president's science advisor, Frank Press. laying out the problem, giving them basically a 2-hour lecture on the history of climate change and what's going to happen next. And they figure that this will be enough. And it isn't. And Hansen, in a similar way, goes through the same process within the scientific realm where he publishes his papers and figures that, you know, if he publishes them in major journals like, you know, Nature or Science, you know, smart people will act. That doesn't work. That's sort of the end of the first phase, first act. Then they realize, well, we need to take this issue to the public. That means they have hearings on the, you know, congressional hearings. Hansen talks to reporters for the New York Times and elsewhere. And this is now sort of early 80s. They start to get some more press, and yet it's still not enough. And the issue falls away when the government, in a major report, concludes that, you know, there's no reason to act, even though the science is as bad as everyone is saying it is.
Having looked into this sort of deep history of this specific period of time, what lessons can we take from this attempt to face climate change, this ultimately failed attempt? And what do you think the, you know, your protagonists would do differently?
I mean, the lesson I take is that an appeal to rationality is not sufficient to motivate the level of transformational change that's required. Folks like Hansen and Pomerantz, I think they did what we all would do. You know, in the first scene of the disaster movie, when you're given the information, you tell the president, right? You tell the armed forces. And they did that, essentially. And I think the answer has to be, well, even if people were concerned about it, it wasn't a high enough priority. It wasn't, you know, if you looked at any of the polling at the time, even though awareness of the problem was at its all-time high, it was a very low priority when you if you had to rank it. To a large extent, that's still the case. Where we have had major change on major social issues in our history, I think one uniting factor is that the rational appeal is joined by a much more urgent moral appeal. And that wasn't really present during that time, and it really hasn't been present, at least in a major way in the public conversation, really until the last few months. You see people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Greta Thunberg, the Swedish teenagers leading these school marches, the young folks in the Sunrise Movement. They're no longer saying, the science is real, we need to act. I mean, of course, they're saying that too, but they're also saying, your inaction is robbing our future away from us. You are killing us. You are destroying, you know, our dreams of a safe and a healthy life for ourselves and our children. And failure to act is wrong. And that's a different kind of argument, and I think it's ultimately a more powerful argument than simply, we're stupid not to act.
Nathaniel Rich is a writer at large for the New York Times Magazine and author of Losing Earth. You can hear more of his conversation with the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier on our Trump on Earth podcast. That's at trumponearth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holzapfel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. The Sears Sweatland Family Foundation supports our coverage in Ohio. And the Robert F. Schuman Foundation supports our podcast, Trump on Earth.